This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, a look at the nature of adulthood. How do you know when you're grown up? Is there a rite of passage you have to go through? When did you become an adult? Give us a phone call tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Today we're talking about radio. We've spent the first part of the program exploring how commercial radio has been affected by changes in technology and FCC regulations. Non-commercial radio, including national public radio, has also been under scrutiny. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Mark Fisher is still with us here in Studio 3A and talking about changes in non-commercial radio. He's a columnist for the Washington Post, where he's covered radio for a long time. And first of all, again, just definitionally, Mark, non-commercial radio is also affected by FCC rules, no?
Well, it certainly is. And most of the stations that are public are owned by universities and other nonprofits across the country. Public radio is really quite a new phenomenon, even in the short history of radio. It's been around for not much more than 30 years in its current form. And NPR, which has been around about that long, is a national programming source, and there are others as well. But all of the public radio stations are locally based and at some point in their history provided largely local programming. What's happened that's changed a lot in public radio in recent years is that stations are taking more and more national programming from NPR and other sources. And that has led to a debate within non-commercial radio about what the real service ought to be. And there are quite a number of people who say that this is better programming. People want the news and the resources that NPR brings to bear. On the other hand, they feel a loss, or many listeners feel a loss, of local programming, particularly of the kinds of music that commercial radio does not provide, the classical, the jazz, the bluegrass, and so on. And what we've seen in recent years is a number of consultants who have persuaded more and more stations to jettison a lot of their local programming and carry more of the national programming, such as this program. And it's a real conflict. Obviously, both are good quality programs. When you take more of the national programming, you lose that local voice and what makes that station feel like that place. Mm.
And again, those choices are being made by the local stations.
Exactly. And so these are choices that are being made hundreds of times across the country, but they're driven by the same kinds of forces, both the new technologies that allow the satellite programming to be provided to stations across the country, so there is a more professional sound. On the other hand, you have stations that are wondering how to compete against the commercial stations and how to maximize the listener donations that they depend on. Mm-hmm. And there are consultants who've made quite a career of making the point that it's the news and talk listeners who provide more of the share of donations than would the listeners of classical and jazz and other music programming.
Okay, let's get some listeners involved. Angela joins us on the line from Eugene, Oregon.
Hi there.
Hi there.
I'm calling about our options here in Eugene. We have a wonderful local radio station, KRVM. It's mostly student-run during the weekdays. It's an educational opportunity, so you'll hear real live local programming. We do have a wonderful NPR-type station, too, but we actually stopped listening to that because I think maybe an effort to try and compete with some of these broader stations, they seem to be playing a lot more jazz. And I like jazz, but this other radio station, they play everything from, like, they have an a cappella station, they have a bluegrass station, the things that you really, really want in radio, and it's key to us because having young children, we got rid of our television and our computer.
I can hear the young children.
Yeah, so this is, you know, pretty much the radio and books are our link to the world. The sad and scary thing is, because it is non-commercial, everything has to be community raised, and since it is educational, a lot of their funding, I guess now more in the past, especially here in Oregon, it did come from the state. They recently had to get cut off from that. And the scary thing is because, you know, there's only a limited amount of bandwidth, their radio station now has a pretty fat little price tag on it. And so, you know, it could possibly get sold for like $1 million or something to Clear Channel, and we'd be losing out. And it's such a precious resource that I can't believe our own entertainment and information is being turned into a commodity like this. And you get people, you know, there's one guy who goes from 2 to 7 in the morning and he has, you know, he'll play like Abbott and Costello shorts, and you just don't hear that on the radio anymore.
I've had that shift, and I can tell you exactly why he's playing the whole bit. Anyway, thanks very much, Angela. We appreciate the phone call.
Uh-huh.
All right.
You know, there's been a big debate within public radio from the beginning about whether the idea is to go for the largest audience possible or to serve those people who are not served by commercial radio. And to do that, you want to play the kinds of music that maybe only a few people want to hear. So that station up there is playing jazz, and maybe you don't like that and you'd rather they play something that has broader appeal, or maybe you want your own special brand of music. Mm-hmm. It's a real conundrum for any station manager to be in, because you want to serve as many people as you can. That's why you're on the air. On the other hand, in public radio, there is that special obligation to serve people who are not served elsewhere.
Jonathan joins us now from Salt Lake City in Utah.
Hi. You know, I was just thinking this, and you started to cover this on your program, but in Salt Lake, we've got three public radio stations. One of those stations used to do a lot of wonderful classical music. They dropped it, at which point I dropped my support of them. I've got, you know, maybe five different chances to hear the Mariazzi Brothers every weekend, and the programming itself is so repetitive and ultimately so boring that I think even though what's happened to commercial radio in this country is worse than appalling, you guys are doing the same thing. There is much less diversity. I am going to stations I can get over the internet in order to hear classical music and in order to hear other things that are interesting. And I wonder if this is just going to ultimately be the death knell for radio, because we can get other things that we're interested in very easily. That radio will be marginalized just as AM was marginalized when FM came along.
It took a while to happen, but go ahead, Mark.
Well, ever since the mid-80s, when the Republicans launched the assault on the funding of public radio, there's been a real deep need on the part of public radio to find secure and generous donations, and that they turned to listeners for that. And so the strategy has been to maximize those donations by playing the kind of programming that draws the most contributions, and that tends to be the news and talk programs. So you're losing those other programs, and what happens in cities with multiple public radio stations, unfortunately, in recent years, has been that many of them are deciding to go head-to-head with exactly the same programming. We have a good example of that here in Washington, where Morning Edition and All Things Considered are aired on both of the major public stations at exactly the same time. It's certainly true on the West Coast, where you can hear multiple stations playing the same programs at the same time. And I hear a lot of complaints from listeners about that sort of thing, but it's each of those stations, in their views, fighting for their financial life.
You also have a lot of state-operated public radio systems where there is only one public radio station in each market, so it's different depending on where you are and how the system was set up, but history has a lot to do with it. But, Jonathan, obviously you think you need some more choices.
Oh, yes, this is the same logic that's being used by Clear Channel to justify their policies, and I think it stinks.
It is very much the commercial model, and the differences between commercial and non-commercial radio are not what they once were, and you hear that in the kinds of commercial announcements that are on public radio, which become more and more akin to what you see in public television as well, which are more and more like ads. And so those changes have been brought about as the funding structure of public radio has shifted over the years. But it's also true that there is this sense throughout the industry of wanting to get the largest possible audience and trying to accumulate mass of listeners. And that was not always what stations were in the business for.
So I miss this, and I think it's short-sighted. I mean, I grew up in New York City. I grew up on WBAI. I really miss that.
Thanks very much, Jonathan.
So impersonal, and thank you very much.
Okay, appreciate the phone call. Jonathan calling us from Salt Lake City, Utah. We're speaking with Mark Fisher, who's writing a book about the history of radio since the invention of that broadcasting with pictures thing. I forget what it's called. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go now to Earl, who joins us from Quincy, Massachusetts.
Yeah, hi. I think there's a message here that in Boston, which is the fifth or the sixth largest radio market in the country, with perhaps 30 stations, that in the fall rating period, a public radio station which is all news and talk, rated number one, ages 25 to 54, number three, ages 12 to 54. Now, that you could say that's due to the war, but in the year 2000, in the winter ratings, they rated number four, ages 25 to 54, and number eight, from 12 to 54.
Actually, I attribute that to their excellent choice in midday talk shows.
Well, that could very well be. I would, too. And so, you know, and it doesn't have the strongest signal here in the South Shore. We sometimes have problems getting it. But the message is not to sell the public short. You know, commercial radio is so, it's just copycat. And I think that we should listen to the public.
Well, you're absolutely right. The classic example in recent years was the album "O Brother, Where Art Thou," the music from the film of the same title, and it sold 6 million copies at record stores across the country and couldn't buy a minute on commercial radio. That's the sort of thing where commercial radio has defined itself out of the tastes of a large portion, not a majority, but certainly a large minority of the American public.
Could I add one rather humorous thing? In Boston, with one exception, all the major commercial stations are absentee-owned. And the one commercial station that is still locally owned is locally owned because the founder left it in his will that his classical music format couldn't be changed. So I find that interesting.
Well, there's an act of will there, perhaps, that keeps it on the radio. Thanks very much for the call. I appreciate it. One of the things that Earl referenced is the idea of these, he was saying, you know, they have difficulties on the South Shore. Well, that radio station and many other public stations have been getting these so-called translators, repeating transmitters that can take it in the case of a Boston station down to Cape Cod or some of the resort areas. But it's happening all over the country. And the other big competitor for unused non-commercial licenses in this country are religious broadcasters, and they are snapping up licenses also at a great rate.
They certainly are, and that's raising the price of non-commercial licenses to an unheard-of level, and that increases the pressure on public radio stations to maximize their donations and their cash flow. So all of these trends that we've been talking about are only hyped up by the pressure from religious broadcasters who are hungry for additional frequencies across the country, both on FM and AM.
Let us then go to Eric, and Eric is on the line with us from Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Hi, thanks. I just wanted to make a quick point about the difference in the relationship between the audience and the station of commercial stations and non-commercial stations. And that would be that I think the non-commercial stations have a little more honest relationship with their audiences because they do directly depend on them for funding, whereas with commercial stations, it's considerably different. The audience is not the customer. The advertiser is the customer, and the audience is the product that's being delivered to the customer.
Eric, you've listened to those fund drives.
yeah, one too many. I've done a few myself, too, so...
Well, thank you for the testimonial. We appreciate it. I think there is a difference.
All right, thanks.
Bye-bye. Mark Fisher, before we let you go, one issue we brought up in our other show on the broader effects of changes in the proposed by the FCC regulations, but it did come up, and we were just leaving it for the last minute, is low-power FM, and that was an issue that was raised, and as I understand it, is not up this time.
No, it's not up this time, but it's one of the most exciting prospects for the future of radio, which is small stations that serve not whole cities but neighborhoods or small rural communities. They could be owned by churches, by Indian tribes, by community groups. There's a good example on the eastern shore of Maryland of an environmental group that owns a station. And this was supposed to be an answer to the gaps that are left both by commercial and non-commercial radio in the way that they've gone toward more national programming. It's a wonderful idea. The FCC has been loath to really do it in a massive way. They've done some spot licensing around the country with good results. The problem is that a lot of the other radio stations complain of possible interference by those signals.
And again, before you write, yes, including National Public Radio stations who have complained about possible interference.
Exactly.
Mark Fisher, thanks very much for joining us, and the best of luck with your book.
Thanks very much.
I'll have you back on when it comes out. Mark Fisher is a columnist for The Washington Post, has long covered the radio industry, and he was our guest here in Studio 3A. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.